Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is investigative reporter and award-winning writer Greg O'Brien. Over 35 years' experience writing for newspapers and magazines, he has contributed to the Associated Press, UPI, Boston Herald American, the Cape Cod Times, the Arizona Republic, and the Boston Magazine. He is also the author of several books. In 2009, Greg O'Brien was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease at the age of 59. This month, his amazing memoir about living with this disease will be published by Codfish Press. It's called On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. And I'm talking to Greg O'Brien by phone from his home in Cape Cod. Greg O'Brien, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to start with some of the history of your family. Your maternal grandfather had dementia. Your mother was eventually diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Do you think this history in any way helped better prepare you for your own diagnosis?
Yes. I had a front row seat as a young man watching my grandfather who died of Alzheimer's. And I can remember as a young boy going over to the house, and he didn't speak a lot, and my grandmother kind of took me aside while my mother talked with him, and then I noticed he just kind of nodded, and he just progressed. Then one day, I went in, and all the furniture, which I write about in my book, that had been in the dining room was gone, and there was a hospital bed. This was in Rye, New York, because he couldn't walk up the stairs.
Mm.
And then it progressed more and more, and then he died, and I remember the next day my mother taking me over, and the furniture was back. Mm. And as a little boy, it stunned me, and I realized that nothing would ever be the same.
Yeah.
And then with my mother, I'm the oldest boy in a family of 10, Irish Catholic family, and I was the family caregiver on Cape Cod for her, and I watched her progression. Several years ago, when she was still alive, I started the symptoms of severe short-term memory loss and not knowing where I was in familiar places and not recognizing people. And you could go online and see all the symptoms. And then I had a serious head injury from a bicycle accident that doctors said unmasked a disease in the making. It's almost similar to what you read about with pro football players who are prone to dementia and they get hit in the head.
Yeah.
And then I had the brain scan, the SPECT scan, the clinical test, which confirmed the diagnosis. And I also carry the Alzheimer's gene, a marker gene for Alzheimer's. And at that point, the doctor said that you're not getting out of it. So
I said,
okay, I could crawl up in a little ball and be in a pity party, which I did for a while. I could raise my fist at God, which I did for a while, or I could sit down and maybe do something constructive, which was to write a book about what it's like to deal with the demon of Alzheimer's and kind of put a focus on the myth of Alzheimer's, that Alzheimer's is just a disease for 80-year-old people when you're in a nursing home and you don't know who you are and incontinent. I'm incontinent at times, and 60% of my short-term memory is gone in 30 seconds. I don't recognize where I am in familiar places and familiar people. I see things that aren't there, which is an impolite word for hallucination. Incredible rage and all of that. And there's millions of people out there suffering in the early and mid stages who are living with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
The dying part comes later. And that's what the book is about.
I know. The book was absolutely wonderful. Now, you went on some early drug trials, some drug therapy, and that seemed to help for a while, but it stopped working. So how are you right now? Where are you?
The early trial was this new drug a while ago, which isn't new anymore, called Aricept.
Mm-hmm.
And I take the legal limit now, which is 23 milligrams of Aricept, 20 milligrams of Namenda, which basically reboot the brain, the electrical circuits in the brain, and then 20 milligrams of Selexia and 50 milligrams of Trazodone, which I don't take because it makes me loopy, and I don't want things to make me loopy. And what it does is it can slow a progression. It doesn't stop it.
Right.
Alzheimer's is like having a sliver of your brain shaved off every day.
God, that must be unbelievable, Greg. Now you talk about how the creative, focused right side of your brain is still mostly functional, but it's the left side where judgment and executive function come in that's failing so rapidly. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that doctors know about Alzheimer's, and there's a lot that they don't, and we don't have a cure. So Alzheimer's is like a snowflake in a funny sort of way. There are no two patterns that are the same.
Mm-hmm.
My mother taught me how to fight Alzheimer's, and she was on a similar track as me. And I think if I hadn't watched her, I would be lost at sea. And I used to think of my brain, probably like a lot of people, as a big garbage pail. And I would throw all sorts of stuff in, good stuff and bad stuff and stuff that no one really cares about, nor should they.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get into the progression, the brain's ability to absorb is less. And so now I think of my brain as like a flower pot. And I intentionally try to pick and choose, as my mother did, what I'm going to try to protect, and the rest I just let go. And if I can't write, if I can't speak, which is the essence of who I am, I mean, beyond my soul, put me in a box.
Mm.
And so that's has been my daily focus. If you look or study or anyone wants to read about it, they have strategies for people with music and art and writing and all those that tend to make people come alive a little more with the disease.
So in some ways this made you have a different focus about your mind. We take our brains for granted in so many ways, and this makes one actually have to think about what to put in it, what to hold dear, what to cherish.
Yeah, you have to reevaluate your life. And for me, I know this sounds odd, but Alzheimer's was a blessing in the sense that, if I said in my book, and someone else came up with this line, but it's a wonderful line, anyone who doesn't think they're going to die someday, please raise your right hand. So I know the ending of my book before I read it, but it's allowed me to focus on the imperfections in my life, and with family and friends and all sorts of things, that maybe I could do some things better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changed me. I'm still as imperfect as hell, but that's changed me.
How did you deal with some of those hallucinations that you talk about in your book? I had never heard about that phenomenon, and it seems to be prevalent. How did you talk yourself out of believing that they were really there?
Well, what happens at different stages is that the brain can't absorb certain things, okay? And the signals don't go down. A small example, there are times now where, and this is an hallucination, but it's an example where I'm sitting stationary and I'm seeing things around me move. But there are times when I see things that aren't there. And my mother, and if you read the book, which is a wonderful book, Still Alice, being made into a movie now.
It's a magnificent book. I read it a couple years ago.
Lisa Genova wrote the foreword to my book and is a very good friend. It writes about these kinds of things. And with my mother, she saw holes opening on the floor and something trying to pull her down. And it just was horrifying. And so I write this in my book, and it's painful to talk about it, but if it's going to help people, I have to live every day, and I'm dealing with this, and I'm trying to encourage people to deal with it if they have to walk through it.
Mm-hmm.
And fight as long as you can. But I will, as I talk about, have seen, it's like a platoon of spiders, real scary creatures coming across the ceiling. This is all times of day. It could be 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and they kind of float at me. And first couple times it was just absolutely horrifying. And then I remember my mother taught me just to ignore it, so I kind of brush it away. And in brushing it it also tells me that it wasn't there. And I mentioned in my, I have a strong faith. It's a traditional faith, but there's an apocryphal story about Martin Luther, not the wonderful man Martin Luther King, but Martin Luther in the 1500s, whenever he lived, who was basically under attack by Satan, and he would have these horrific dreams, and he woke up in the middle of the night and saw Satan sitting at the end of his bed, and he sat up and he said, "Oh, it's just you," and he went back to sleep.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so when I see those things now, I just say, "Oh, it's just you."
And it finally dissipates if you don't pay attention to it, correct?
Yeah, well, it can hang for a while, but you just ignore it, and you realize it's not real.
Mm, God. One of the symptoms that I've heard of from everybody I've ever heard of who has Alzheimer's or dementia is not recognizing people. How have you dealt with that? You sometimes don't recognize your wife, so do you wait until you sort of come back to? How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, it's difficult to talk about, but good example. This is just Sunday after church. I went down to the local coffee shop to write, as I usually do. And it was a place I wasn't used to seeing my wife. And she walked in, and I stared at her. I knew she was a person of interest, but for that moment there, I didn't know who she was.
Mm.
And I find now that a lot of people are coming up to me and reintroducing themselves because they could tell if I see them out of context, I may not know who they are.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that puts me at an advantage as a trained reporter, I've learned how to ask questions. So if I don't know, I'll keep asking questions to try to figure out who you are. Let's say I had met you. And if I couldn't, I'm hoping that maybe at the end of the conversation, you didn't know that I didn't know you.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had friends of mine who watched this, and I've walked away, and they said, "You had no clue who that person was." And I said, "Yeah, and I didn't know who that was."
Wow. God, that must be really frightening. To tell us how your family has dealt with this, your wife, you have three children, two sons and a daughter. How has it changed the way they live their lives and the way they treat you?
Well, it's brought us closer. My son, Brendan, who's 30 years old, he's a writer-producer in Boston, and when I told him, he paused, and it was a difficult conversation. And then he said, "Well, that explains a lot." Because
mm-hmm.
he had been noticing things.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise with the kids. It has brought us closer. They've gotten involved in the cause. They know that I'm a fighter. And like my mother, I will fight until I can't. And with her, it took her out real quick when she had no gas left. And they talk about, and this is a layman's term, not a medical term, but cognitive reserve. Some individuals can work off maybe an extra fuel tank of reserve. And, you know, when that tank is gone, as my mother did, then they're gone. And, you know, it can allow you to sustain things longer. My wife is deeply worried about finance, and the kids are also worried about, you know, what if they have the gene? And Alzheimer's in most cases is not genetic, but in our family there is a gene. So
if you're just joining us, my guest is Greg O'Brien. We're talking about his book On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. Greg was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's back in 2009. Now talk to us a little bit more about...
By the way, just so anyone who's interested, the book has just come out. It will be in bookstores soon, but it is on Amazon, and it is on my website on Pluto.org. But you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it on Pluto.org.
Yeah, yeah. To talk to us more about this cognitive reserve, they say that you kind of have a backup tank of inherited intellect. Does that have to do with education or just an inherited intelligence?
You know, it may have to do with simply exercising the brain. You know, there are all sorts of points of view on it. I was a jock in school, in high school and college, and I was taught never to give up, don't give in, and when you're hurt, you play, and you keep going. And so, you know, when I get up every morning, which I write about in the book, it's like before I get to bed, I got to put the five W's of the who, where, what, when, why, and how of my life back into my head. It's like someone ransacked my files. And then I go to the bathroom where at times I don't recognize the toothpaste, or it happened once where I gargled with rubbing alcohol rather than mouthwash thinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know the difference, but my brain said, this is good. I wouldn't recommend it. And then you get into your daily routine. But every day is like getting up for, and this is the jock in me maybe, every day is like getting up for a game, knowing you're on the disabled list, but you got to play.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you try to do. And you try to get breaks in between, and you got to sense sometimes when you're done and you need a break, and other times you don't. You know, I've said in my book that I feel that my brain, and I'm sure other people who are dealing with this, is like an iPhone, you know, still a sophisticated device. You can't do without it, but it pocket dials. It has a short memory or a battery, and it shuts down without notice and gets lost a lot.
I want to talk to you about writing the book, because that's a huge undertaking for anybody to write a book. What were the logistics that you used to write this?
Well, first of all, my neurologist said, because he knew my background, he said, you need to write about this.
Mm.
And so several years ago, I started taking detailed notes. And actually, I started doing it before the neurologist said, write a book. This is the reporter in me, been a political investigative reporter all my life at papers around the country. And it just instinctively, I said, you got to take notes. You got to take notes, man. You got to take notes. And so I took notes of my mom's progression, my progression, anecdotes. I kept like 850, 900 pages of notes. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And then something inside me said, okay, now's the time to do it. And it took me 2 years to write. And with a lot of help from a lot of supporters, couple New York Times bestselling writer friends of mine, Lisa Genova and LeClaire William Martin, another editor in Providence, Robert Wickham, and others who helped me, and you know, they gave me direction and gave me feedback, and it was a very helpful process.
Yeah, it's an absolutely amazing book, Greg. I must say, I do recommend it to everybody. Now, you described Alzheimer's as a death in slow motion. Can you talk to us about what that actually feels like?
Yeah, you sometimes you never know who's going to show up in yourself. You know, you asked about the brain, and I don't trust my brain anymore. It used to be my best friend. And now I don't see chance for reconciliation. And so you see that dying. And what happens, and again, I don't know how to explain this, and I'm sure the doctors disagree, but all I can tell you is from my perspective, and nobody knows because we don't have a cure. So I've learned to speak and write from my heart. And again, I have a strong faith. And so rather than going to my brain, I've learned to train myself to go to my heart. And that has sustained me. But you get part of Alzheimer's is the tremendous rage that you go through. And there are times when I pick up a phone and I don't know how to dial. I don't remember. And I throw the phone across the kitchen because I'm angry, mm-hmm. and I'm a lawn guy, and you know, I got an acre of lawn on Cape Cod, and I pick up my sprinkler, and there were times when I didn't know what it was, and I threw it against the oak tree to smash it in a million pieces because I was angry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So rage and anger or something, and depression. The Alzheimer's, you know, brings on or accelerates depression, and you got to deal with that.
Yeah, yeah. You've said that there's an inner spirit that defines most of us, and that inner spirit remains intact. You still feel that, right? I mean, that's what you're describing.
When we get to heaven, there's going to be a big press conference, and I'm going to have my hand up raised high because I got a lot of questions to ask. But I believe that's our soul, and this is just what I believe. I'm not trying to proselytize anyone, but the soul survives, which is who you are. And I remember telling my mother when she was lost and scared, and she was crying, And her name was Virginia, maiden name Brown. And I said, remember that little girl, Virginia Brown, a little girl who grew up in Manhattan and then later lived in Rye, that little girl who became a mother of 10? That little girl is still inside your heart. She's still there. She said, really? And I said, believe it, Mom. And she took a big sigh of relief. And I believe she felt that.
Yeah, yes. It was comforting to her, and she could identify that.
Yeah. Wow,
that's amazing. Now you've been bringing up your faith, the Catholic Church, of course. Is this a challenge that has brought you closer to your religion? Or with some, you know how some people rage at God, saying, why did you abandon me? Tell us a little bit more how this has perhaps changed your faith.
I did rage at God, and as I've told people, I was raised Irish Catholic. I'm probably more evangelical Catholic, but I've told people, don't tell my relatives in Dublin because I'll get stoned. But there, in my book, I talk about a scene in my office where I'm writing, and the brain shuts down, and I got so angry at God, it was expletives that I mentioned the book that I can on radio about, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You don't care, I'm trying to do the best, where are you? And then I realized I had a meeting, and I left the office, and I went out, and my Jeep, the left rear tire was flat as a pancake, and I exploded into a torrent of expletives again. Four-letter words, yelling and screaming at God, and limped down to the gas station a mile away and told the attendant, who I knew, a young kid, I said, just fix this blank thing. And he came back a few minutes later, and he said, you know, I have the culprit, and you may want to see it. And I said, I don't care what it was, just fix the tire. He goes, no, Mr. O'Brien, you want to see this. And he showed me a piece of bent metal that was bent into a small piece of metal that was bent into a perfect cross. That cut, and I've shown that to people, and that cut right into my heart. I started crying. And I felt God saying, okay, can we talk now?
And saying perhaps that you can deal with this.
Yeah, you can do it. And, you know, sometimes for God to get your attention, he's got to bring you to the lowest ebb.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am, blasphemous. And he pulled me out and said, here's the cross, pal. Who's got your back?
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the most stunning, you know, it brings tears thinking about it. It was one of the most stunning moments of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it gave you complete faith instead of feeling like you were abandoned.
I never look back from that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward.
Mm-hmm. How have your friends treated you? Have you had relationships changed greatly?
Well, my good friends, they're probably people who, because people don't want to talk about, I mean, dementia, I took Latin in school, and it's got a derivative of a demon howling in the woods, so
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to go there. But my good friends have supported me. They know that I don't want anyone to kiss my ass or pity. They support me, and they give me a lot of crap. And a lot of my friends will end a conversation, which is happens now because they all heard it, by saying, "Greg, remember, you owe me $100."
That's great.
So, and I love that. And I said, just keep giving me crap.
Now you did this book and you're doing this publicity to give a voice to Alzheimer's, because obviously there isn't enough funding, there isn't enough research. Talk to us more about what you know about what we are not doing and what we need to do.
Well, we're doing a lot of good things, but it's not nearly enough. Anyone can go online and Google the statistics. Alzheimer's is expected to knock down the baby boom generation. It's been said in 25 years that there'll be two types of people, those with Alzheimer's / dementia and those caring for people with Alzheimer's and dementia. We do a lot of good work with cancer, and we do a lot of good work with AIDS, and we do a lot of good work heart disease and ALS and autism, and, mm-hmm. and I don't want a single penny less spent on that. In fact, I want more money spent on that. The numbers on Alzheimer's are numbing, and Alzheimer's is expected to outpace cancer and heart disease sevenfold in the coming years. And I've seen the inside of a nursing home, and they're wonderful places, and I don't want to disparage. We have incredible people in the nursing homes. They're heroes. But I've seen my mother, and I don't want my children and my wife to see me with a loss of self in a nursing home. And this is in my book, and you probably know this. I also have prostate cancer, and I'm not treating it as an exit strategy, because I've chosen that I don't want my children and wife to see me at that stage.
Mm-hmm. Greg, we're almost out of time. I want you to give some contact information if you can, and I will as well. Go ahead and tell us what if you have a website.
The name of the book is On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. It's getting a lot of good national publicity. It's just been released. Mm-hmm. It'll be in bookstores soon, but right now you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it on my website on Pluto.org. So that's Amazon and on Pluto.org.
Yes, and I want to tell my listeners, there's a short film about Greg. It's called A Place Called Pluto, and you can go view that at livingwithalz.org.
Livingwithalz.org,
yes. And please go to that. It's a great introduction to Greg, and please go read his book. Again, his name is Greg O'Brien, and the book is called On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. Thank you so much, Greg O'Brien, for joining us. And we wish you well for the future. Thank you for your bravery.
God bless you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. You
bye-bye.
Take care. Okay, bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.